Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we tell you each week, this conversation includes you if you'd like to join us. 941-3689 is our number if you call us from Oahu. Use that one. From the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, you can call us at 877-941-3689. Now, of all the dynamics this campaign season, perhaps the biggest political phenomenon of these elections is voter anxiety. Despite an economy generally on the upswing, many voters in both parties are deeply concerned about income inequality, job opportunities, and whether anyone can have a real shot at the American dream. Opinion polls show more Americans worried about terrorism than at any time since 9/11. Some fear that illegal immigration represents a major threat. And while crime rates continue to drop, gun sales are higher than ever. Now, with less than just a few days to go before the Iowa caucuses, NPR and many member stations around the country have been engaged in an exploration of voter anxiety, and we are wondering how that's playing out in Hawaii, if it is. In Hawaii, where it seems to be more anxiety, there are more anxieties over low voter turnout than perhaps anything else. Tonight, we're going to talk about that with HPR contributing editor Neil Milner and HPU communications professor and media watcher John Hart. And you, again, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. John, Neil, thanks very much for making the time.
Aloha.
Thank you.
You know, we've talked about a lot of these things in fits and spurts, but as we're now sort of in this buildup before we're going to hit campaign season truly in earnest and seeing what happens on Monday with Iowa, we come back to the ideas that have been percolating in Hawaii, and a lot of them about us in particular have been that we accept things like over the last 25 years, Hawaii has had low voter turnout, and that'll continue, and gubernatorial years are more engaging than presidential years. Hawaii is more concerned with what happens in Hawaii, in the legislature, the governor's office. Are all those ideas really, truly more mythologized now, or do you see them continuing with a real basis in fact, aside from the real numbers about low voter turnout?
I think they're a solution that's looking at the wrong problem. If you want to increase voter turnout, one of the ways you can do it is to get a lot of Trump supporters or get a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters. What's happening that's increasing political mobilization on the mainland, and particularly in Trump's case, is that you're getting a lot of people who normally don't participate and don't vote as often as everybody else into the political process. And what I'm trying to say by that is this: if turnout is not the issue that people should be concerned about. Turnout and voter anxiety are two very different issues. And a lot of people whose political views that I'm sympathetic with, when they talk about increasing the turnout, have to understand that there are consequences to doing that that they may not necessarily like. And one of them is to bring in a lot of people who support Trump or turn into supporters of Trump.
John?
Well, absolutely. In times of crisis, demagogues become popular. And that's what Donald Trump is. And I don't know why we just won't say that. I mean, you think about Huey Long. You think about Father Coughlin in the 30s. You think about George Wallace in the late 60s, early 70s. And demagogues arise during these times. And I think the real myth isn't about apathy or voter turnout. It's the myth that in America, we really want everyone to vote, because we really don't. I don't think the founding fathers ever did. And I agree, you know, with Neil that, hey, if everyone did vote, I'm not sure we'd get the results we want. And that's a really difficult thing to talk about when we espouse the myth of democracy in the United States.
That's a very tough thing for people to swallow, because they've been told for such a long time that it's their civic duty to get out and vote. We tell that to kids. We encourage them to go and have their first voting experience when they can. And then there are some of these realities that we begin to see play out as we're seeing it now.
Well, yeah. let's stay democratic with a small d for a second. You can argue that it's everybody's civic duty to vote. You just have to live with the consequences that increased participation may turn into things that you don't necessarily like. An exaggerated case, and I don't want to say the U.S. is anything like this, just an example that helps people understand, is Egypt. When democracy opened up in Egypt— It brought in all kinds of political players and participants that weren't there before. And ultimately, it led to a great deal of stability and probably right now in a worse situation as far as authoritarianism than they were before that. Is it still worthwhile doing it? Maybe, but you have to understand that turnout has consequences, just as John said.
Well, you know, again, Democrat small d, the theory depends upon an informed electorate. So the question is, when the electorate is not informed, should they vote? And what no one wants to talk about is the answer is no. And when you have in a situation where more people know who the Pro Bowl captains are than who their lieutenant governor is, they probably shouldn't be voting. They do not match the criteria of the informed electorate. But that is something we don't want to say. We don't want to talk about how elites best perpetuate democracy.
Interesting that you bring that up, because just a few days ago, Nicole Brody was on the show. She's the executive director of Kanu Hawaii, an organization that's been out there with engagement campaigns now several legislative sessions, trying to get people to understand the process, be able to be engaged. They've been knocking on doors to register people to vote, all of that. And I asked her, I said, you know, really, though, aren't you trying to create an informed electorate? And she says, no, we want people to get out and vote. Because if they get out and vote, her point was that whoever is elected is going to feel that there are people watching him or her and saying, you know, that's your job that we put you into, and that there will be more responsibility. But that could mean that you would wind up with someone who wouldn't have anything to do with you whatsoever.
Yeah, I understand the ideology, but history shows that when the mob votes, they elect a dictator. That's harsh. That's the historical record.
Well, I'm a little more tolerant of people not knowing a lot. One, because I guess there still is a thrust in me that worries that elites get to identify who's informed or not.
Yeah.
But I think the other reason is that there's all kinds of research that shows that the more informed people are, the more ideologically intolerant they are, the more that they look at only things from one side. And that's also a dilemma. I mean, I can speak from my own personal experience and experience of the people that I talk to. You get folks, most of my friends, I guess, are liberals. You get folks who are liberals. They don't want to pay a whole lot of attention to any kind of conservative argument, any kind of conservative media. They just find it, if not the work of the devil, at least irrelevant to the way that they think about stuff. And so you have that other kinds of issue in addition.
That's not just with, you know, some of your friends, but the fact
that
we live
it's a
blue
phenomenon.
And blue
yes.
state
yeah.
and the fact that we have never really had a robust two-party system, that it just seems to be an ongoing situation that doesn't really see any solution anytime. And certainly, I think in my lifetime, it would take a whole lot to change.
Well, we also, you know, Hawaii is a young state. It's a young state. I mean, when you look at Ohio or Virginia, they've been doing this longer. And we don't want to talk about that. But, you know, this is something I think we're still getting used to. We spent 50 years under a Republican rule as a territory, another 50 years under a Democratic rule as a state. We just had, the great Senator Inouye, who, you know, ran things, and we're now learning how to do it ourselves. I think time will provide some of this.
That the state's more in an adolescent phase than
anything
else?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Tonight we're talking about what's happening on the national stage, national conversation surrounding the issue of gun control and everything that's been happening with people concerned about terrorism and looking it up and trying to find more out about it, and is it going to affect them, and will there be something happening that will be devastating on American soil? Just a lot of anxiety about those issues, but the overarching dynamic seems to be just the voter anxiety itself, being fearful about being fearful. And the question is, is there something about this election season that's causing you to be more anxious, or are you just not engaging at all? We've said very often that Hawaii tends to be at arm's length from a lot of the mainland phenomena. Is this one kind of like that for you? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Now, you can't turn on anything without someone saying the word Iowa. And, granted, the Iowa caucuses will be Monday, and we'll have some indication that may or may not give us.
Yeah, I miss the good old days when you couldn't turn on anything without them saying New Hampshire.
Yes.
Oh, well.
All right. 2 points for you. But the point is that for people who live in Hawaii, where there's also a caucus that just seems to go totally unnoticed and disregarded, that this really doesn't have the same kind of verve that for anyone on the mainland who's just myopically trained on Iowa, that it would have. So how do you explain that to someone here in terms of importance or why they should care, or even if it has any relevance at all for people in Hawaii? Are we really so far removed from it and so down a certain path that it really doesn't have a whole lot except for maybe entertainment value?
Well, the answer to the last one is that we're sure down the path. Here's a few reasons why this is different. The first reason is that Iowa is different in terms of visibility and interest from any other caucus. There may be 10 or 11 states that caucus. So in that sense, Iowa stands alone from Hawaii and all the others. But there's all kinds of other reasons. First of all, it's first, and that makes a big difference. Secondly, it lends itself to media coverage. It's an easy state to cover media-wise. The third thing is that candidates get around there. It's easy to do old-fashioned retail politics. And so you find them all the time in churches, pizza parlors. It gets covered very well. All of those things tend to be the most important reasons. It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's an early test, and because it's an early test, it gets more visible, and then people begin to see it as more important. Hawaii is the totally opposite. It happens later in the year. It's far away. The candidates don't want to come out here. It's never really made any kind of difference. We've never had an election close enough that those four things would be there. So that's the reason. In many ways, it's media driven, and particularly on the Republican side, the winner of the Iowa primary usually doesn't do anything. The Democrats are a little bit different, and Jimmy Carter helped to establish the importance of the Iowa primary because he came out of nowhere. This unemployed governor in the South managed to win that primary, and that helped mythologize it.
Some of what you said just seems to make the point about, you know, why we kind of shouldn't care or why it doesn't have any real meaning for us. And seemingly, you know, I don't want to say disenfranchised from all the media and the process, except to look at it and maybe enjoy it or find it as entertainment.
It's because they're first. I mean, that it's simply that. If you look at them, they are atypical states. It's not like Ohio or Florida where they vote statistically makes a difference. These states are statistically aberrations in terms of demographics. There's simply the states that go first, which is why we're interested. But if you are following this race, it could make a difference. If Sanders were somehow to win Iowa and New Hampshire, this slows down Clinton LLC. It's going to make people think.
You know, John.
And the same thing on the Republican side. I mean, if Cruz were to get both of them, or Trump were to get both of them, the Republicans are going to have to start accepting who they're going to get in bed with. And so, I mean, if you follow politics, it does make a difference this time around.
Yeah, they're jigsaw. I mean, campaigns are really jigsaw puzzles with many pieces. And if you really want to follow totally and see where all the pieces are, then this could be one of the pieces. It's just...
And you're probably watching the GOP debate and not listening to us.
Not listening to us, hard as that is to believe. But I think that the idea that this will definitely be a game changer and do anything definitive, I think, as John says, it can certainly be important, but it's not going to... It's just the beginning.
All right, let's go to Michelle calling us from Kaneohe. If you'd like to be next, our number is 941-3689 if you're on Oahu, or 877-941-3689 if you're calling us from the neighbor islands. Aloha, Michelle. Thanks
Aloha.
For your patience.
Okay, I have a question for you guys. Worst case scenario, either Cruz or Trump end up being our next president. Are there, first of all, enough checks and balances to keep Donald Trump's ego in place? Because I really am afraid that he's exactly the kind of ego that would get elected and then try to declare himself emperor.
Well, you got John Hart laughing. Okay, John, you got to go first.
Well, no, Donald would want to be king, not emperor. But, I would have to say,
wouldn't be good enough for him.
I would have to say, first of all, the political wisdom, for whatever that is worth, is that the Republicans would be very concerned under a Cruz campaign that they would lose the Congress. So there would be one check there. Trump, for all his boisterousness in social policy outside of his immigration policies, actually fairly liberal. And so, a matter of fact, many Republicans have accused him of being a wolf in sheep's clothing because of that.
Because he was one.
Yes, yes. I just don't think the Republican would be in danger with either one of them. We can statistically talk about Cruz's chances, which I think would be difficult against a Democrat candidate. I think Trump's chances, we can talk about why that could be problematic against a Democratic candidate. I think if you want to draw up, and I want to put quotes around this nightmare scenario, certainly the most interesting race would be Cruz or Trump versus Sanders in terms of forcing the American public to make a true choice, which is why Bloomberg is going to spend some money to see about a third party candidacy.
Yeah, the one thing that a lot of the things that the founding fathers wanted to see happen, they wouldn't believe right now because they haven't happened. But one that definitely works is checks and balances, that they designed a system purposely to delay, to obfuscate, to make it very hard to bring about changes in any kind of dramatic sort of way. Right now, we label that gridlock. But in fact, the separation of powers and checks and balances really is there to keep an authoritarian kind of person, or any kind of person for that matter, from being able to carry out his or her will very much. And I think that's one of the institutional checks that you would have on this.
Yeah, if you notice the intuitive wisdom of the American public, most of the time they put one party in the White House and the opposite party controls the Congress. And that's probably been the key to our functioning under the same governmental unit.
And that's likely to increase considering the various things that have happened in the last 10 years. That's going to be more of that.
All right, Michelle, thanks very much for the question. We hope that eases your anxiety just a little bit. 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. If you're calling us from the neighbor islands or listening to the live stream, we're talking about this election cycle, voter anxiety, not just over issues, but over the process itself, and over the issues and overlaid with the process. Anything you want to talk about tonight that you're concerned about, you get to call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Craig, calling us from Kauai. Aloha, Craig. Welcome to Town Square.
Yes, thank you. The polarization of the political parties, the preaching to the choir, whether you're liberal or conservative, the candidates tend to get their media time based on exaggerating, the problems and the real discussion of details, science and agriculture and some of the things that are really the future, especially for Kauai. Agricultural science, conspiracy theory has thrown out any rational discussion. You can't even talk about the real issues, which are building up the soils and other things, because you have conspiracy theorists throwing out bloody nose and other kind of false claims. We would like to see politicians get back to more of a discussion of the details and stop using false fears as a way of mobilizing support.
All right, Craig, I'm going to stop you there because I'm finding it really interesting that he called up talking about a very localized idea of how we should be talking to each other using what's been happening with ag, and I take it the issues of pesticides and GMOs.
Here on Kauai, we have we want to limit housing. We want to have a secondary industry to tourism. So agriculture is a fabulous solution to that as we transition out of sugar. But the conspiracy theorists on both sides take some wild claim, throw it on the wall and it's sticks.
Okay.
Sticks and media covers it instead of having a real scientific debate.
Well, and sometimes it turns out to be a conversation of my science is better than your science. So, you know, that's argument that happens on both sides. I'm glad you called.
Well, what we're seeing is, first of all, is that all politics is local, and that's true, you know, in Kauai or Oahu or Kirksville, Missouri. Secondly, I think our caller's talking about two different issues. I'm not sure there was a golden age that we need to go back to that politicians were more specific. I don't think they ever were. In terms of party bifurcation, this is a result clearly of the direct primary system. If you remember the caucus systems in the 60s, the criticism was they produced candidates that were too similar. Nixon and Humphrey got this laid on them. And so we now have a direct primary. Well, who votes in direct primaries? The extremists, the true believers in the party. So now you're getting people that are much more differentiated. So we got our wish. We wanted direct primaries. We want people that are different, and they're different. The problem is you nominate someone on the right, someone on the left. Most of America is in the middle. We are socially liberal and physically conservative. And what happens when the major parties do not produce candidates that reflect that?
Yeah, one of the things I want to say, polarization is a pretty complicated issue that it has lots of dynamics to it. And just put that aside for a second. One of the things that's very clear now is that science has become polarized and politicized. You see this in all kinds of areas. Once a scientific issue, and the best one that you could, the most visible one has to do with public health, once it becomes an issue or climate change that politicians talk about, two things happen. People take their cues not from the scientists then, but from the politicians, from the political parties they support. Science is complicated. I don't understand it. I don't trust liberals. I'll turn to conservatives or vice versa. That's the first thing that happens. And secondly, the policy elites in climate change, the people who know something, congressmen, all these others, silo themselves. They take a position that is one way or the other, and they get the information about that position only. And both of those things are very different from the way scientists work and very different from the way that you want to assess science. And that's changed. John's right. I mean, you have a low bar for details that people talk about, especially in primaries. But that dynamic has changed.
We talked about this a bit on the Longview segment that we do on the morning show. And again, going back to the idea of if they're in silos and they're using bits and pieces of science to say mine is better than yours, and you're not having anything that is pulled away from that process, then how is anyone really going to know?
Well, by the way, Senator Schatz today gave a very nice speech on the floor of the Senate that involved a bipartisan bill that passed that's money for some kind of environmentally technical issue. And one of the things that he said, besides talking about the bill, one of the things he did was to thank the Republican chair of the Senate committee first by saying that it worked very well and they worked together. That's a small, just a pinpoint of light. But it was.
You'll take what you can get.
What you can get.
All right. We've got lots of callers on the line. Let's see about getting them to the two of you. Trevor calling us from Kahului. Aloha, Trevor. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for getting me on the show. Yeah. It's pretty hard to find a point where you can actually find any common ground and solution to any of this stuff. But I suppose talking about global warming and the science, just to put in a comment there, listening to that, is I don't know where you guys are right now, but it's pretty awful on Maui today as far as the vog is concerned. Anyways, hopefully the trades will be back soon. But I was born and raised in South Africa, and I'm just really blessed and happy to be in the United States. But I must say I've never, ever voted. And I certainly don't have voter anxiety because I figure I'll puzzle things as I go. It makes no difference to me who's in power. Whoever's in power, I'm going to try and figure out what I can do best in order to try and make my life as easy as possible. Obviously, right now with the economy is pretty good, everything's pretty good. But then I suppose if you print $3 trillion, things better be good, you know. So I don't think it makes any difference really at all. I just say one thing, you know, growing up in South Africa, I destroyed enough votes because you used to get the percentage of destroyed votes, and oftentimes there would be more destroyed votes than either of the nominees would get, you know. So anyways, I just don't think that it makes any difference.
All right,
Trevor. I don't vote.
Trevor, thanks very much for the call and for bringing up that point, too.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you. That point that, you know, maybe to the average person, it doesn't matter. I mean, we've heard that idea come around now and again that, you know, when we look at it as politics being local, that's where people feel they have some sense of control and accountability. They know their neighbors. They know what's going on in their own neighborhoods. But that when you start to look at what's happening not only over the ocean but a country away, even if that policy may affect your life in some way, a lot of people don't even logically sort of extend the thoughts into that.
Well, you know, the cynic in me certainly identifies with the idea that both parties are the same. They're paid for by the same corporations. What difference does it make, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there are times in history when voting makes a difference, right? Those 20,000 people that voted for Ralph Nader, you know, what if some of them, not what is it, what if 700 of them had voted for Al Gore? There's no question in my mind the world would be a significantly different place today. So, I mean, once again, it's you know, very, you know, bland to say, but I would say people who don't vote deserve the leadership they get.
I don't care.
All right.
Frankly, I don't care. In the sense, not be cynical, but there's all kinds of reasons why people don't vote. And I think you have the idea that you somehow morally stigmatize them for not voting or saying, you know, don't vote, don't complain. I don't know. I mean, we have all kinds of choices that we make. And I prefer to I would rather see a person engaged in politics than not engaged. And I mean, I taught political science for years and we did a lot of talking about it. But in fact, it's as much about how attached you get to the political system. Young people tend not to vote because they don't have much attachment yet. They haven't paid taxes. They haven't paid mortgage. They haven't had to deal with things that way. I think if you take a moral position on non-voting, it's harder to convince a person to vote than if you take another kind of position, which is, let's say, quasi-moral. If you just say you don't vote, you don't deserve to get stuff. It turns out it's more effective to say, you know what, your neighbor voted. And other people you respect voted. Now, in some ways, that's a kind of social pressure.
A little peer pressure there.
Yeah, but it's not the same kind of stigma. So if you want to change people's minds, that's one of the ways to do it. It means you have to go to door to door.
And start to make people coalesce.
Yeah, well, not coalesce. You have to talk to them. I mean, you actually have to ring their doorbell.
Well, ring them, talking, but saying, your neighbor is doing this, and I've talked to this one, I've talked to that one. And then you start to see people, you know, come into their own groups. 941-3689 is a way of getting to our little group around this table tonight. If you are on Oahu, use that number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. On Town Square tonight, we're talking about voter anxiety. Does that describe you, either for local issues here or with what you're seeing play out on the national stage? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Mike calling us from Kaneohe. Aloha, Mike. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm also a non-voter, and I've never voted, and I wanted to voice my feelings about that. You know, I think that having a two-party system was originally a good idea in there, but what's happened now is that the system needs to be revamped. And I don't think we have bad politicians. I think we have a system that causes them to become that way, that in order for them to be good at their job, they have to play the system. And people like me, I'm just tired of I'm not going to go out there and pick the best of the worst of the group. I'd rather not pick anybody. So somebody like Donald Trump coming in is like throwing a fox into the chicken coop. And it's kind of neat to see what will happen because he's coming from a totally different point of view. But I think our system needs to be changed, but it cannot be changed from the inside. Somehow it has to be changed for the outside.
All right. Neil Milner wants to be able to answer you.
No, Mike, I'm just saying that as a non-voter, you're a minority kind of non-voter in the sense that you have a kind of principled reason that you give for non-voting, and you're pretty well informed about the political system compared to a lot of other voters. That's not saying I share your assessment, but you talk about Trump and so on. A more typical non-voter is a voter is a non-voter who just doesn't pay attention, doesn't know very much about the political system. That's the more typical kind of one. Doesn't know very much, doesn't care very much. You care, and that's why you're not voting. That's the exception to the rule.
But what separates that from what everyone else may do?
Well, one, he pays attention. He's more informed.
No, that's true. Yeah. But in terms of you look at what happens, what results happen when he talks about you can't fix the government from the inside out, you know, presumably something else would have to happen to be able to change the
depends,
system.
It depends what else he does in his political and social life. You can't just decide whether a person is an active citizen on the basis of whether he or she votes or not. Most of the time, voting is like the first step. It's the entry into a more active political life. But in this case, it might not be. In this case, it's possible to hear what Mike says by saying, I'm doing other things. I'm not fomenting a revolution necessarily. You don't know what else he's doing in civic life. And you don't want to dismiss that possibility just because he's a non-voter.
Which kind of goes back to the point that we started to talk about a little earlier in the show, the idea that the voting is being the be-all, end-all, that you're not an engaged citizen if you don't vote. And, you know, if you don't vote, you get the government you deserve. All of that, which goes back to your point, Neil, also, about being rather moralistic about it, whether you're, you know, condemning somebody for being apathetic and not engaging or just simply telling them why they should up one side and down the other. If someone like Mike says, well, hey, I'm paying attention and it just has...
One of the things the founding fathers talked about was civic virtue. And there is no evidence that indicates that civic virtue is limited to voting.
To voting, yeah. All right. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open. We want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Taking a look at this election season and a lot of voter anxiety that we hear about in conversations on the mainland, and we've been hearing them lately on NPR. And maybe you're having one or two with people that you care about and trust. Want to hear what you're having to say about politics here in Hawaii, and as you're watching what's happening with the presidential campaigns, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Claudette, calling us from Kaneohe. Aloha, Claudette.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just feel that, number one, it's a privilege to vote. I take it really seriously. I listen and watch and form my opinions. I think what's discouraging for me is that when we vote here in Hawaii, everything is based on the electoral vote, and so it always goes to the Democrat, and that discourages me because I feel like my vote didn't even matter because we don't look at the whole thing on the people vote.
Claudette, are you referring to the Electoral College in the presidential elections?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the four electoral votes.
Okay.
So, but interestingly enough, though, I mean, you've just said that you don't think your vote really counts, but yet you haven't stopped voting because you feel it's a privilege.
No.
I'm wondering if this is more.
I feel that it's a privilege.
Yeah, we heard you say that, but I'm wondering, both with John and Neil here, some of this is generational, depending upon, you know, how long you've been in Hawaii and the fact that we had the highest voter turnout ever, right after statehood, and watch that, you know, continue along a very nice path until about 1992, and then it began to just devolve to where we had the lowest voter turnout in the nation last cycle, despite a contentious Senate race, despite having a gubernatorial candidate unseat an incumbent, all the things that you would have thought would get people up and juiced to be voting, and in fact didn't.
Well, there's actually a difference of opinion generally about the role that generations play, that there's two ways of looking at it. The assumption used to be that the older you got, the more likely you were to vote. And that still holds pretty well. But there's some evidence now that it was the World War II generation, which would be picking up that 1950s Democratic Revolution in this state that made a difference, and that turnout is not ever going to reach is not going to reach that level with this group because it's a different set of experiences. It's not just that you're old. Nevertheless, the older you are, the still more likely you are to vote compared to younger people. It's just that overall the turnout's lower.
I want to bring up Kona Hawaii again because one of the things that they have been able to do is get young people activated by going out and knocking on the doors. But interestingly enough, they had a phenomenon they didn't expect, which is that they began to develop a coterie of leaders and people who were taking on more leadership roles simply after, you know, having been involved with the activity of knocking on people's doors and just trying to get them to register to vote, having nothing to do with any particular idea or issue, just asking them and giving them paperwork so they could register to vote. So doesn't that sort of come back to the idea of the, you know, the more you put yourself out there to be engaged, the more engaged you are?
Well, I think it's, I would look at it a somewhat different way. I would look at it by saying that whether Kano knows it or not, they're doing a really good job on a very challenging issue, that it's very hard to get young people mobilized even to vote. And if they can get them involved, that's a really success. And I'm thinking that the way they do it, especially if they're doing it to leadership roles, is the way that organizations do. You get people very much attached to Kano and its mission, and you do a lot of informal storytelling, actually, about what the organization is trying to do. There's a lot of schmoozing that goes on, and these people get drawn in. They start as volunteers, and they become much more interested in leadership roles, and you have them around a longer period of time. That's more formidable than just to get them to vote. I'm not saying Kano does this with hundreds and hundreds of people, but I'm guessing that they're very good at that, whether they're self-conscious about it or not.
I think that we need to remember that although the older you are, the richer you are, the more educated you are, the more likely you are to vote. At the same time, public policy is very labor intensive. And it's often young people, when mobilized, that actually do the footwork. I mean, you can see this in Bernie Sanders' campaign. We can talk about a bunch of examples. I think it's true in the local campaigns as well. But that doesn't necessarily mean your young boots on the ground are voting or that your old voters are out knocking door to door. They're two parts of the process, and they both have value.
And some would say that's part of the continuum, that you have to grow into it and age into the process. You don't just simply, you know, hop over a few steps to suddenly be there where someone who has been voting for 2 or 3 decades already is. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 to get you right here where we are talking about the political process this campaign season and what a lot of people have termed the season of anxiety, a lot of voter anxiety about issues and about the confluence of those issues in a way that we really haven't seen for a long time. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689.
You know, no one has called to talk about the issues that the national polls show are the most important manifestations of anxiety. Immigration, terrorism.
You're making my point.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah,
and
that's
wonder
exactly
why that is.
Well, and maybe because, as John
also,
reminded us, politics
also
is local.
Also, anti-African-American sentiment, the rise of terrorism, concern about people not paying enough, the big shots not paying enough attention to us. I'm not saying that they don't exist here, but we're not hearing that kind of stuff.
All right, let's see what we are hearing. We're going to go to Kathy calling us from Maui. Aloha, Kathy. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha, Kako. I just want to say something about people's feelings about the election. Personally, I listen to George Norrie on Coast to Coast Radio a lot. I used to vote all the time. You know, an active person, I've worked on people's campaigns. Locally, the big turnoff is when you put something on the ballot and you get signatures on a petition to put it on the ballot, you go out and get more people to vote, huge turnout, and then the ban that you were hoping for, that you voted in and it was passed, gets turned down when Monsanto and the mayor decide, oh, we can't enforce that. So that's a big turnoff for people to participate in the voting process.
But Corey, hang on a second. But Corey, I mean, interestingly enough, also bringing up the issues about pesticides and GMOs and contentious issues that we've seen that live and breathe with you where you live and breathe. But you were going to mention about national issues. What are you paying attention to there?
Well, nationally, it seems as if the candidate that wins is going to be the one that's related to the Queen of England. If you trace them all back, they've all been related to the Queen of England.
Okay, all
that's
right.
Like a conspiracy theory, perhaps. But I mentioned it to a hitchhiker I picked up today because I wanted to shock him and say, oh, well, elections don't mean anything. They're just shows, you know, because the winners have already been picked by the people with the deep pockets. And he says, oh, exactly. He said, it's all just like a big survey to see where the people are thinking.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there. In the interest of time, not to shock anybody else. But we have a lot of these stories that sort of move around, and for some people, they're fun to talk about. But I want to get back to some of the issues that are really living and breathing with some of you. Going to Corey from Waialua. Aloha, Corey. Thanks for your patience.
Corey, thanks for having me on. Hey, I have a comment, you know, not about some of the national headlines going on, except for I've been in the weeds on campaign finance reform quite a bit. And what I come across a lot, obviously, you know, these conspiracy theories pop up and you hear people talk about things and, you know, people are frustrated. They don't know what to do. And I hear a lot of people talk about the two-party system and that there's this ultimate frustration with the stalemate. So I hear a lot of people talk about a third party. If we could only inspire a third party or get a third party. And what I've tried to tell people over the years, which I don't know if it's right or wrong, I think it's right, but I'd be interested to hear Mr. Milner's response, is that you should be focusing not on a third party, but you first need to focus on instant runoff voting, which it allows people to pick their first candidate first. And if that candidate doesn't get 30% of the vote, it goes to their second choice. So they can sort of vote their conscience. And if that candidate's not viable, then it goes to their second choice. Because I think a lot of voters, if they want to vote for a third-party candidate or whatever, they can't because they're afraid that, the whole Nader thing. I didn't vote for Nader because I didn't want Bush to get elected, that sort of thing. So anyway, that was just my comment. I'll take that.
Okay, Corey. Thanks very much. And you'll get both Mr. Milner and Mr. Hart. All right, Mr. Milner, you may go first.
Two for the price of one here, John. I mean, the simple answer, and I don't mean it to be flip, is that third parties never win. They haven't won, and they're because of the Electoral College, because it's hard in a winner-take-all situation to win. So third parties have played some important roles, and at various times they've gotten as high as, maybe 20% of the votes. But they don't win. Your other idea is an intriguing one, but it shows the difficulty of bringing it about. I mean, that would require a constitutional amendment. And to get constitutional amendments passed in the way the U.S. Constitution works is very, very difficult. So what I've given you is two really high bars that you would have to get over in order to make a third party work. Now, you have a candidate who's got lots of money and is a good politician in his own way, thinking about it, and that's the former mayor of New York, Bloomberg. But as he's a very canny guy, and even though he can afford to drop a billion or two on his own campaign because he's a multibillionaire, you can bet that the first thing that he's thinking about is, can I win? And the first thing that will keep him out is the usual things that would keep that from happening.
John Hart.
Well, there would also be another thing. I like the idea of, you know, a priority balloting, right? Here's my first choice, here's my second. And our caller Corey talked about being in the weeds on campaign reform. Well, I've been in the weeds on working as an election official. And people have a hard enough time with the ballot as it is. If we had to explain your first choice versus your second choice and how this works – oh, wow.
And in many languages.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, to hear the conversations that go on behind that curtain while the couple decides how to vote is a great moment in democracy.
John, you're a little young for an election official. The demographics of the election officials, that's a good place for the elderly to do volunteer. Well, they get paid a little bit, but it's basically thankless volunteer work.
Yeah, so. Well, the deal is, though, is now a lot of them have electronic machines. And so that's the true. Normal demographic goes, we're not touching it. So, yeah. You know, I'm always happy to be. I'm always happy to be in a situation where I'm the young one that knows tech, because being a college professor, I never get to do that.
Well, yeah, you're the IT guy, yeah. Really.
All right, it's the Milner and Hart Show. No, we're also talking to you tonight, and the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Michael, calling us from Manoa. Aloha, Michael. Thank you for your patience.
Oh, thank you. My issue with the political system is that whenever we vote for, like, mayors, governors, or presidents, we tend to vote for them based on their political issues. But that's only like half of their job, because they still have to run the country or the state and whatever. And what usually ends up happening is we get somebody in who has really good political ideas, but they don't really know how to run the state or whatever. And so projects are way over budget, they take way too long, and it's really turning people off, and we don't really have faith anymore.
So good ideas that meet practicality and go splat.
I'm sorry?
Good ideas that may meet practicality and go splat? Nothing happens?
Yeah. It's like the rail, for example. We spent way more than expected, and still not finished yet.
But there are a lot of people who warned against that.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what I'm saying. Nobody has faith in the system anymore, because we know before it even happens that it's going to be over budget. It's going to take too long. That's one of the main problems I have with our system.
And yet, people have changed in that issue in very recent times. Is it just simply that's the course of things and it's happening and it's not going to change?
Well, governance is a greatly underappreciated and very, very difficult task that doesn't get nearly the attention that it does in Hawaii. I mean, to me, the biggest problem in the state of Hawaii is not bad ideas. It's lousy governance, the nuts and bolts, the way things run every day. But I think that when you elect mayors, I think the people vote. The more you get away from political parties as a cue, the more likely you are to consider competence. Now, he may not like the competence of the mayor, and I don't have any trouble putting together the link he's making between the mayor and rail. But I think that folks, when they make choices for that office, which is nonpartisan, the competence issue comes in a little bit more.
Well, I'm certainly sympathetic with Michael's point that we seem to be developing a trend of really developing politicians who are really focused so much on the campaign, they don't have as much of a clue as to what to do when they actually, govern. At the same time, for example, we just elected a governor here in Hawaii who specifically ran on, I'm not a public speaker, I'm not a good campaigner, I'm an engineer, I'll look at all the evidence and I'll do the right thing. And let's see how that works.
It's exactly. Let's see what it works. It's not too much of an exaggeration to say that elected officials don't govern. Bureaucrats govern. The everyday political life of a community is affected much more by the kind of decisions that bureaucrats, and I don't mean that in a bad way, state employees, bureaucrats make, whether it's ordinary thing like who gets a license, who doesn't, or who gets the procurement for some kind of contract. That's the heart of governance, and we pay way too little attention to this process.
Why?
Because it's not sexy, because it's hard to supervise, because it makes you raise questions about monitoring and expenses that add to the upfront cost of a policy, and that's the reason. You and I have discussed this a little bit before. You can look at the fact that for years we've had this terrible IT system, and that we do such things as paying people for unsuccessful work and say that's just a bunch of bozos. And all you need is competent people. And my response is, if it's been this way for 20 or 30 or 40 years, something else is operating there about the organizational culture and about the way that people exercise oversight over this that is much deeper and a much more important issue than you think.
Our number is 941-3689 to tell us what you think about this election season, or perhaps how you're viewing politics entirely. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. something that Michael says, well, you know, we knew it was going to go over budget, speaking about rail. You know, we knew it was going to take longer. Well, if we knew that, then why are we surprised? You know, I mean, going back to this, if we know that's about right. governance, if we know if it's about accountability, if we know that we have all these problems with it, then it seems like, you know, we like to be ticked
Who's
off.
Who's the
we
that knows this?
From what he says, you know, people talking about it, it's going to go over budget. I mean, this is going more to the colloquial side of it, not necessarily anything that's quantifiable, but it's happening longer than it takes to go. You know what's happening with money. You see the fact that it's going to be more expensive. Anybody who's built a house will tell you that, let alone a rail system.
Well, you know, that is something I think as an informed electorate you use in your calculus at the same, you know, that, yeah, if the government does it, it is going to cost more money. At the same time, I can see how this feeds into cynicism that says, well, you know, no matter what I do, you know, things don't work, so why should I bother? I mean, our earlier caller, I think it was Kathy, on the county GMO issues. I mean, the reason why those failed were because they sent them up the wrong flagpole. And they did it twice. And so on one hand, it raised consciousness. It did give you a public barometer. But there was no legal chance of that stuff winning because, you know, state and federal law trumps county law. And I'm sure it was very frustrating for the people who didn't understand that and thought, hey, we voted. Why aren't you being listened to? Well, right. But, you know. Hey.
So, but whose fault was that? I mean, the fact that from the very beginning when that was put together, that there wasn't enough due diligence, that there wasn't enough real information being given to everyone about the process and what the real process should be, as opposed to just let's get everybody together and say we want this, and if we send it up, it's going
to
work?
If you wanted to do this in a realistic way, politically realistic, and this is hard, what you would say is in effect what John just said, which is every public works project of any size, not to mention any private development of any size, is likely to go over budget. And it's likely to take longer because that's the nature of trying to predict things in an uncertain world. In this case, there was a competence issue. They were way off. I mean, who decides the cost of rail on the basis of construction costs during years when construction workers aren't working and the bids are low, and then the bids go out many years later?
That's going back to the due diligence.
But I think there's another dynamic that worked here that has to do with why this kind of disaffection. I think when you do these big public works projects, you finally have to reach a point where people say, okay, who knows how it's going to work out, but it's now a technical issue. We trust the engineers. You know, they may make mistakes, but it's not a big major political mistake. This thing never got to that point. Even when you had these referendums and these surveys and whatever, you never got to a kind of cushion of trust. And so you add those two together, it's the perfect storm of a screw-up.
We'll quote you on that one, the perfect storm of a screw-up.
Well, yeah.
All
perfect
right.
storm, I created that term.
Okay, well, so we don't do any more of those. Let's go to Jim calling us from the Windward side. Aloha, Jim. Welcome to Town Square. Jim, are you there?
Yeah.
Hi there. Welcome to Town Square.
Apparently you're inviting public comment on the rail system and its cost.
No, actually we're inviting public comment on the political process and looking at issues of voter anxiety, as we've been hearing about many issues causing voters a lot of consternation. But if that's one for you, go ahead.
Yeah, voters are always anxious. But not many of them are terribly anxious about anything. And that's one of the reasons why we get a fairly low voter turnout in Hawaii. You know, I mean, this is a very comfortable place. We have 12 months of summer. And sand, surf, and beach, and you know, I think there's a high correlation between high socioeconomic educational level and voter turnout. I think people in the lower ends of the population tend not to turn out. I think that's what the statistics show. And I don't think that's going to change. It hasn't changed at least since 1959. And I see no impetus. Well, you know, people talk about it. They say, well, you know, I'm interested in...
Yeah, but actually, you know, 59 to 92 was a pretty good period for voter turnout, and a very good period for voter turnout from the rest of the nation. But, you know, his whole point that maybe people are too caught up in their lives here to get out and vote. And he's, again, looking at the voter apathy issue and whether or not people are too busy to vote, all of that, which we sort of handled before. But we're coming up to the last couple of minutes of the show here, and I want to talk to you all about what you see going forward for us. We seem to be in a place that's very different from the last time we were all sitting around looking at an election. And it feels different, even if people can't name exactly what they're feeling, and we sort of use this term voter anxiety. For a lot of people, this election does feel different. And not just because of the entertainment factor, perhaps, or the zoo factor, some might call it, but there's a lot more going on that hasn't shaken out by this point. You guys are pointing at each other. Okay, who wants to take this one on? Are we really at a different point than we have been in the last section?
Ask me a month from now. And okay. I make that statement for obvious reasons and one for not so obvious reasons. The obvious reason is that things that would make it like that haven't happened yet. You have a sense of how people's anxieties are and what they're thinking, but there hasn't been choices made yet. The second thing, of course, is that, as we've talked about before, experts, in quotes, are lousy predictors. And on this one, it's very hard to predict. So it could very well be that this will turn out to be, you know, it's one thing to have feelings and the other thing to have to make choices between people who don't necessarily manifest what you're thinking. That's what happens a lot in politics, where ultimately it comes down to a Democrat or a Republican who don't necessarily share the things, and you decide to vote for one or the other. But the main point is, too early.
Okay. Is it really too early, John? I mean, given the fact that we've come through a pretty, you know, violent year, looking at what happened with a lot of violence in cities, with African-American males being shot, police reform being called for, a lot of the kind of contentiousness that, you know, maybe 5-6 years ago we weren't really talking about in the way that we've been talking about in the last couple of years. People looking to guns, people, you know, sitting there and Googling about terrorism and trying to find out more. There was a Google statistic thrown out there, 400% more than in 2008, people wanting to find out about terrorism, really being concerned that on our soil there's going to be something terrible that will happen. Again, it may feel different, but when you look at just some of the issues, it seems we're in a different place.
Well, I think there is more anxiety. If you go back to what we talked about at the beginning of the show, the rise of the demagogue always happens during these times of anxiety. But where I think Neil is correct is we're at a point in the political process where we're going to see whether or not that anxiety translates into a change in public policy. And it's at least 1 month to even begin to talk about that.
Which means you guys have to come back in a month or so. And we have to sit down and do this all again.
That's precisely why we answered the way we did, so we could get another
gig
on the show.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, for the moment, we're going to have to sort of let this go and see where we go a month or so hence. But any other parting words that you would offer people as they're looking at some of the issues that are being commingled with a lot of the anxiety?
Hey, when you were describing what this place is like today, what the United States is like, it sure sounded a lot like what 1968 was like. And the interesting thing is that in 1968, we elected a moderate conservative, Richard Nixon, to be president. That not because I voted for him and not because I thought that he was going to settle a country down, but that's maybe a moral there.
All right, John, 30 seconds.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. Bernie Sanders is Eugene McCarthy. I understand that. To our listeners out there, you heard us talk for a long time about anger and angst, and my parting words are the Republic will survive.
All right. Well, on that good and positive note, we'll say goodnight to you, John Hart and Neil Milner. Thanks so much for joining us, and you too with your phone calls. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you back here tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock for The Conversation. See you then.